It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. International law enforcement partners, including the U.S. Attorney's Office for Western Pennsylvania, announced last week that a large malware conspiracy network had been taken down. So what does it mean to go after a villain you can't really see? Joining us in studio to talk about what it takes to apprehend, not just bring charges against cyber criminals, is U.S. Attorney Scott Brady. Welcome back to The Confluence.
Good morning, Kevin. It's great to be here.
So remind us, who was charged? What did they do?
So this was a 10-person conspiracy that was charged here in the Western District, charging an international malware campaign that targeted businesses and financial institutions throughout North America and Europe. I think, though, it's important to step back and kind of talk about the threat broadly and then what our response looks like and then what this is in this particular case. Your listeners and you are certainly aware of cybercrime generally. It's the topic of every media report. It's on the lips of every CEO, every small business person, every elderly resident in Western Pennsylvania. Everyone is a target. And so what this really is this is a threat that we've never seen before in law enforcement. It's a criminal activity on a scale and a scope that we haven't seen. It's also evolving incredibly quickly. And so the threat that was posed to businesses and to citizens of Western Pennsylvania even 3 years ago, 4 years ago, is not the same threat that we're seeing now. And we see these cyber criminals move with incredible agility. And so what that requires is a response from law enforcement that is equally broad, equally agile, equally kind of entrepreneurial, creative, and opportunistic. And so that's what this case, we think, represents.
Right. 10 defendants, I believe, different countries. How many are in custody?
There are 10 defendants and then one defendant in a related case.
All right.
The defendants were in 6 countries internationally. 5 are currently in custody and being prosecuted. And we talk about this case as really representing a paradigm change in how we prosecute cybercrime. And what I mean by that is the traditional method was either a bilateral or a multilateral investigation. And what I mean by that is we would identify actors, usually based on victims here in the West and in Western Pennsylvania. So we identify victims in Western Pennsylvania. And then, like any criminal enterprise, we follow the money, we follow criminal activity, we start an investigation. Historically, that meant if we found an actor overseas, we would interact with law enforcement in that country. And then they would send us evidence, send us information. We would prosecute here in Western Pennsylvania. And we would then hope to extradite, and sometimes successfully, sometimes right. not. But that extradition process triggered a very long, labor-intensive, and sometimes unfruitful attempt to put hands on someone, bring them before a court in Western Pennsylvania and a jury of 12 citizens. This is different.
And how so?
What we're doing now is, and why I think this case especially represents a fundamental paradigm change in how we fight cybercrime, we have worked cooperatively with partners in Germany, Moldova, the Ukraine, Bulgaria, Georgia. And in addition to the usual information sharing and working together, what we did was we conducted searches together with local law enforcement in those countries. We worked hand in hand with prosecutors in those countries. We shared information with them. We shared evidence with them. And we helped build their prosecutions. So what we announced was a simultaneous prosecution of an international cyber conspiracy in 4 countries at the same time. So the United States, Moldova, the Ukraine, and Georgia are all prosecuting members of this conspiracy at the same time.
That announcement in the Netherlands last Thursday, was that to sort of show goodwill, to show this partnership that you're trying to build, or what?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So it communicates, again, that this is a new paradigm change, that we stand shoulder to shoulder with our international partners. And it announces to the cyber community and cyber criminal community that while your crime is borderless, our response is going to be borderless. And we are going to work together, share information, prosecute you, put hands on you wherever we can find you.
Were Pittsburghers hurt in this particular case? Yes. Pittsburgh businesses?
Yes. Several Pittsburgh businesses were targeted. And the victims in this case ran the gamut from international corporations to mom-and-pop shops. There was a nonprofit that worked with disabled children that was targeted. In Newcastle, there was a paving company that was targeted.
Right. Now, your predecessor as U.S. Attorney, David Hickton, he pursued cyber criminals as well. A lot of indictments, but often people that, let's say, we couldn't get our hands on. So what's your approach to be able to apprehend people who are committing these cyber crimes?
Sure. Whenever we engage in cyber crime, cyber prosecutions, our goal is to really accomplish three things. We want to disrupt the criminal activity that's going on and make it harder for criminals to attack victims in Western Pennsylvania and all over the world. We, in some cases, want to call out criminal activity, especially when it's sponsored or protected by certain nation states. And that's usually, unfortunately, Russia and China. Mm-hmm. And our ultimate goal is to arrest people, put hands on people, and hold them accountable. Again, the evolution of law enforcement and our response is trying to accomplish all of these things. And so that's why this case is unique, because we're doing all of those things. We've disrupted criminal activity. We took down a bulletproof hosting network called Avalanche that provided protection, and it was really a marketplace, a supermarket of criminal skills that cyber criminals would bring together. Five of the defendants were in Russia. We're calling out Russia and saying, these people are your citizens. You're protecting them. They need to be held accountable. And then we're, as we discussed, arresting and putting hands on five of the members of the conspiracy.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is the U.S. Attorney for Western Pennsylvania, Scott Brady, who's leading a coordinated effort to go after cybercrime. Briefly, I want to ask you about one more thing that was announced actually earlier this month, taking down a dark net site. What's the importance of that site or of that action, and what is a dark net? I mean, how do you take down a site?
Yeah, there's confusion about what the dark net is, the dark web is. It goes by a lot of different names. And really, very simply, and I'm an attorney, I'm not a computer scientist, but briefly, there is the clear web, which are basically websites that are available to be searched and identified by traditional searching methods like Google. So you search for Dick's Sporting Goods, Google connects to the Dick's Sporting Goods server, that returns on your search result, you're able to access that immediately. Then there's what's called the deep web. The deep web are basically databases of information that are not available by searching methods. Those could be academic repositories of information of the universities, could be financial records.
Right.
Then we have the dark web. And the dark web is an anonymized network of servers and information that are not accessible by traditional search methods and is structured in a way to keep the identities of both people entering the dark web and activity in the dark web anonymized. And they break that down by masking IP addresses of people entering the dark web and then bouncing your search and your path to different servers that host activities through hundreds or dozens or hundreds of servers across the world. So the dark web then serves a number of different functions. Not all of them negative. For example, in countries where journalism is illegal or repressed, journalists can communicate via the dark web and be anonymized and protected from, oversight or persecution by government agencies. We see that in China, for example, where they block certain information, certain news outlets, and so people can access the dark web. For law enforcement, it is the home to a lot of illegal activity, including the sale of opioids, fentanyl, firearms, child pornography, and the like. And that's our concern.
All right. As you know, the city of Baltimore servers were hacked a couple weeks ago. A lot of their activities are still frozen. 20 municipalities have been attacked this year. I talked to the mayor earlier, Mayor of Pittsburgh, about what precautions they're taking. Briefly, what advice can you give to municipalities to protect themselves?
This is a pervasive problem, as you know. Municipalities, there are a number of steps that municipalities can take to update software, to segregate the locations of their data, to protect themselves and educate their employees, to protect against potential intrusions. What I would say is, if any municipality would like to talk about what they can do to protect themselves from ransomware, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the FBI, the Secret Service would be happy to talk with them how they can strengthen their firewalls against that kind of activity.
All right. We have just about a minute left. I would be remiss if I didn't mention something, but I know you are limited in what you can talk about when it comes to the Robert Bowers case. There's another proceeding today in federal court. Is this just another step in the process? What can you tell? Is this just a regular part of the process?
Sure, and I'm sorry I can't talk about the case itself. This is a status conference with the court and the judge to just talk about scheduling and what she is going to see from both parties going forward. What I can say is that you can rest assured this is the most important prosecution that our office has, and we are not limiting ourselves by any resources to make sure that justice is served in this case.
Do you feel any special pressure about that? You said the most important case.
We are treating this as any prosecution. The Department of Justice has the best prosecutors in the country, and we've put our very best prosecutors on it, and so we're confident that we're going to do this in the right way that honors the memory of the victims in this case.
In a sentence or two, we talked about you going after opioids. We talked about cybercrime in the past and this morning as well. What do you want to do?
I think broadly what we're seeing, especially in the opioid epidemic. The opioid epidemic was clearly the first and largest crisis that I was entering. We're seeing that the enforcement, the efforts of law enforcement can make a difference in the lives of people in Western Pennsylvania. Our call is to protect and keep our communities safe, and we're going to work harder and do that even better.
Scott Brady is the U.S. Attorney for Western Pennsylvania. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence, we'll travel north to Buffalo, where immigrants fleeing war-torn homelands are finding a new life. Today is the 143rd day of the year, and the Wolf Administration wants to make it a special day across the Commonwealth to honor Fred Rogers. And new census estimates out today show that the population of Pittsburgh is shifting beyond the basic numbers. We'll take a look at exactly how Pittsburgh is changing. To get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence, check out our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
The Who released their rock opera Tommy 50 years ago today in their native UK. Tommy tells the story of a boy who was left deaf, dumb, and blind after witnessing a murder. In his isolation, Tommy finds that his lack of external distractions helps him master the game of pinball and eventually learns that his ailments are not physical, but mental. He overcomes them, starts a cult, and everyone abandons him again. It's a rough story, full of compelling music. The album was eventually made into a movie and Broadway musical, and a Tommy-themed pinball machine was released in 1994. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
There are now 23 Democrats running for president. So, do any of them have a climate plan? This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Reed Frazier. The UN says we have about a decade to drastically cut carbon emissions in order to prevent catastrophic climate change. While President Trump dismisses warnings like these, his Democratic opponent will probably have some kind of plan to deal with climate. But what kind of plan will it be? For our podcast, Trump on Earth, I talked about this with Emily Holden, an environment reporter for The Guardian. She said only two candidates in the primary so far have anything approaching a detailed policy on climate.
So Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington State, says that his plan is based on a lot of things that he has done in his own state. He essentially wants the U.S. to be carbon neutral by 2045. And he lays out ways to get there. So he starts with the electricity and transportation sectors and buildings, building up to 2045. And Beto O'Rourke, he has a little bit of a similar plan, far fewer details, but he would try to get carbon neutrality by 2050, and he would spend $5 trillion on it. Inslee, on the other hand, says that he would have the U.S. investing $9 trillion.
Right, and Inslee's, you know, climate change is his one issue. What might the effect of his ideas or these sort of more detailed ideas that come out earlier in the race, how would that affect the race overall?
Well, I think you certainly have reporters paying a lot of attention right now to climate plans and asking all of the candidates, when are you going to release something? Or, you know, have you decided if you're going to take fossil fuel money donations or not? But at the same time, we have the Green New Deal, this proposal from progressives that many of the candidates have said that they would endorse the strategy behind. And I think that's given them kind of a little bit of cover to say, look, I'm backing this really ambitious idea. We'll get the details out soon. And maybe has slowed that process down a little bit.
And this kind of brings us to Joe Biden. And a few days ago, an advisor of his was quoted as saying that he would seek a middle ground on climate change. Do we know what a Joe Biden candidacy represents with respect to climate change?
Well, I think and the piece you're talking about was in Reuters, and it's an advisor to him. And I think his campaign has pushed back a little bit on that idea and said they'll be putting out more details soon. But what that piece kind of envisioned as a middle ground is continuing to use natural gas to replace coal, focusing, you know, really on the electricity sector. And I know that a lot of advocates were really hoping to see something different from Biden. They're hoping that he could reposition on this and go with something bigger and bolder and more in line with what scientists say is going to be necessary. But I can't say that I would be surprised if he put out a plan and it didn't have, you know, an end date for carbon neutrality.
Why would that be important?
Well, and most of the experts that I talk to say, if you're looking for a candidate who is serious about climate change, who is really going to try to fix it, they need to have an end date and they need to show their work on how they're going to get there. They need to show you, you know, they would be looking at different sectors and what sorts of things they would consider in those sectors. And that's everything from electricity, transportation, buildings, to agriculture and land use, things that, you know, we have many of the answers to, but will be pretty big hurdles to just change the way that we're living and doing business in the world.
Emily Holden writes for The Guardian. To hear the rest of that interview, go to TrumpOnEarth.org. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Reed Frazier.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Much of the current focus on immigration into the United States remains on the country's southern border. But in Buffalo, New York, just over 200 miles north of Pittsburgh, a local organization serves as a beacon of hope for individuals and families fleeing war-torn and unstable nations. Ryan Zunner from our news partner, WBFO, reports.
Behind the red bricks of an old school building in Buffalo's Kensington neighborhood lies Vive, a shelter house for asylum seekers looking to make the United States or Canada their home. In an old classroom still adorned with the chalkboards of yesteryear, we meet an enthusiastic Congolese man.
As a young leader, actually, I was involved in some in a kind of think tank, youth think tank. And because of that, I joined an NGO, the National Cycle for Peace and Democracy. We started doing some demonstrations. The opponent side, they created a kind of platform in which many political parties were involved in.
For his own safety, we're not using the man's real name. So here, we're calling him Paul. Paul was active in opposing President Denis Sassou Nguesso's 2015 campaign to change the Republic of Congo's constitution to allow him to run for another term in office. When Nguesso ultimately won his referendum, Paul found himself bound by the iron grips of the powerful Central African regime.
Me and some of my friends were arrested during that time, so we got trouble. I went in jail, then I got released later on. So because in the past I was not like involved in such event, like political things, and then so my family was very worried. They told me, you have to stop because this regime used to do anything.
For a while, Paul did stop. Working as an engineer in the oil industry, he proved to be a rising young star in the Congo. His work brought him around the world for training and business, but after splitting time between the United States, Malaysia, and the Congo, Paul once again found himself involved in the politics of his home country, this time supporting former Army General Jean-Marie Michel Makoko's 2016 run for the presidency. Makoko placed third in the presidential election and was promptly arrested and sentenced to 20 years in prison. Paul says it was then he knew he had to leave. Luckily, he had a U.S. visa that was still valid for another 2 weeks.
But my family didn't. Yeah, I have a wife with one kid. He's 6 years old now. The short-term project is my family to be here because I won't be able to really be focused without them, especially my son. I want him to be here for sure.
Paul returned to the U.S. and made his way to Vive by way of Texas. He's been here since July. But his journey to America is just one of many for asylum seekers looking to escape danger. In 2017, the Office of Immigration Statistics said of the 26,568 people granted asylum, 9.4% resided in New York State. Anna Mongo, chief program officer of Vive's parent organization Jericho Road, says it's not easy to satisfy the United States' requirements for asylum, as outlined by the UN, proving illegal incarceration, threats, violent persecution, and even torture for some asylum seekers can be difficult.
It's not always easy getting proof that you were tortured. I mean, it's not something you can't call up your torturer and be like, hey, can you give me a letter that states that you tortured me? I'd really appreciate it. Thanks. And so sometimes proving some of these cases can be really tricky.
Mongo says the Queen City has been strong in supporting the immigrant community, and many asylum seekers passing through Vive, like Paul, possess specialized skills from their home country that can benefit the local economy.
I just believe that the value of asylum seekers so outweighs, you know, the little bit of cost that we have to put into supporting them during this time. Buffalo is a place where we need a workforce, we need educated people, we need incoming population, and asylum seekers help to do those things. They're people who, you know, they want to start a new life, they want to give back to the community, they want to be self-supporting.
Paul is still in the long legal process of being granted asylum. If approved, he plans to return to school to complete a master's degree in petrol engineering, and hopefully, with his family in tow, start a new life and career here in America.
That was WBFO's Ryan Zunner reporting from Buffalo. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Today, May 23rd, is the 143rd day of the year. An ordinary day for most folks, but it was something special to Fred Rogers, as he explained to Mr. McFeely on an episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
This is a kind of code that we've just found out about. One is I, four, L-O-V-E, three, Y-O-U, I love you.
Now, Governor Tom Wolf wants it to be a special day for all Pennsylvanians. Wolf has declared May 23rd, 143 Day in the Commonwealth. The Confluence's Maria Scapoletto talked with Carrie Fisher-Lepore, Deputy Secretary in the Department of Community and Economic Development, about what the state is doing to mark this special day.
This is meant to honor Fred Rogers' legacy, one of Pennsylvania's most beloved sons, and also to help spread a movement of kindness throughout the Commonwealth.
So this special day goes back many years for Fred Rogers. Why has the state chosen this year, 2019, to launch this initiative?
Last summer, we launched, the Pennsylvania Tourism Office launched the Fred Rogers Trail. This was partially to help celebrate the 50th anniversary of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood last year. The U.S. Postal System unveiled a commemorative stamp. We had that wonderful documentary, and we realized that there was something in the zeitgeist about Fred Rogers. So we thought for this year, why not celebrate kindness, honor his legacy, and try to do something to spread throughout the state?
And since we are in 2019, how is social media going to play a part in 143 Day?
So we're asking people to practice acts of kindness. These are not random acts. These are very intentional acts of kindness. And to post their act of kindness and or something that they see someone else doing to social media using the hashtag 143 Day in PA. We hope that will inspire more people to do the same.
And these don't have to be great acts of service. They could be just something as simple as maybe, what, baking cookies for a neighbor?
Absolutely. Holding the door open for someone. If you're so moved and you're able, buy a cup of coffee for someone, for a coworker or someone that you're in line with. Pick up a piece of litter that you see on the ground.
And what is the act of kindness generator? Explain that.
Yes. So just in case you need a little inspiration for an act of kindness, if you go to pa.gov /143-day, you'll find a kindness generator. We have loaded 365 different acts of kindness. You push a button and you're served one of those acts of kindness. So if you need any help or inspiration, you can go there.
You know, we are just coming off the 50th anniversary of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, as you touched on. It was produced at WQED right here in Pittsburgh. There's been that documentary that you had referenced. And also, we have a film coming up with Tom Hanks in it. So is all that publicity surrounding Fred Rogers, is that boosting visitors coming to the state to find out more about him?
Absolutely. We sure hope so. Last summer, we launched the Fred Rogers Trail, which starts in Latrobe, his hometown, travels through Washington, PA with a stop at the Trolley Museum, and then concludes in Pittsburgh with an overnight stay at the Ace Hotel is one of the suggestions. The Ace Hotel had some significance. That was the former YMCA, and Fred Rogers swam there every day for a million years. So we really tried to make it authentic, and every stop along the way has some personal connection to Fred Rogers.
Do you think that you'll be doing something going forward beyond, May 23rd, you know, to continue this initiative of kindness? Will you be, returning to this next year?
We're really hoping it's a 143-365 movement.
That was the Confluence's Maria Scappelletto speaking with Carrie Fisher-Lepore, the Department of Community and Economic Development, about 143 Day in Pennsylvania, a day of kindness in the Commonwealth. To find out more, go to pa.gov/143-day. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last night, the U.S. Census Bureau released new population estimates. The number of residents in the city of Pittsburgh, according to those estimates, slipped again to 301,048, or 672, fewer than in July of 2017. We're going to look beyond just the numbers and at who is comprising our population with Chris Bream, regional economist at the University of Pittsburgh Center for Social and Urban Research. Chris, welcome back to The Confluence.
Good morning.
So, Chris, we want to note these are estimates. The next in-depth census full count will be conducted next year. But I want to start with, how does the Census Bureau come up with estimates?
Well, so you're right. So next year, the decennial census will happen. That's an enumeration. They're going to look. They're going to come look for you if you don't respond to a postcard they send you to go online. That'll be new this year. You can respond online. They will send you mail, a form you can fill out. And if you don't fill that out, they're going to come look for you. And that only happens every 10 years. There's a lot of data out there that tells us what the population is. The county population is estimated from the number of births we have every year, the number of deaths, and so a lot of different data that tells us how many people are moving in and out. Mm-hmm. And then that's for the county. We break that down to the city level or municipal level by an estimation that mostly relies on building permits. You know, we think people have to live somewhere, so places that are building a lot are growing and places that aren't building are not. So it's an estimate, but it's proven to be pretty accurate overall, but there certainly will be pockets of municipalities that will be different. We'll learn how different they are next year.
Okay. City of Pittsburgh's population did not fall below 300,000, according to these estimates, as some had thought might happen. So are our city leaders breathing a sigh of relief? Do you think dropping below that 300,000 or any threshold has any real significance?
Well, no. But certainly I think there would have been this great angst if we had fallen below 300,000. The truth is Pittsburgh is more than the city proper. The city has not grown. A lot of municipalities expand over time. We have not expanded in a really significantly in a century. So urban Pittsburgh is really encompasses a lot of the inner ring suburbs as well. And there's a lot going on. I think the story, though, is that the city is stable in population. These numbers up or down are very small. This is a city that has been declining for almost a century. You know, people think that the peak's about 1950. But really, World War II had some artificial growth. Really, the 1930s, there was no growth. It was really some annexations of some suburbs. So you have to go back a century to see growth in the city of Pittsburgh. So stability is a good thing. I mean, or is a very different thing. It might be a glass half full or half empty type of thing, but we'll take it.
You used the word angst. So any psychological effect to a barrier, a threshold, when that far left digit changes?
I'm sure we would have a news cycle over this and debating whether it's true or not. And as you say, you know, we may find we are growing or not. I think people see a lot of growth in the city. I think it's much more concentrated than people realize. Even though the top line population of the city is flat or maybe declining a little, there's a lot of change within the city of Pittsburgh's population. So I think we'll be surprised by some things next year. I think we obsess on this a little more only because of our history of population decline. But I call it a persistence of memory. But no, I mean, I think the city of Pittsburgh is doing well as it is.
Mm-hmm. Chris Bream, as a regional economist, you've been studying the factors that have been a positive influence on the numbers and those that have chipped away at the overall population. Let's start with, shall we say, the good news, the things that have bumped up the population, at least somewhat, regarding the overall net. So who is adding? Who is coming here? Who are we getting more of?
So, I mean, I do point out, I mean, the city is one part of the region. The region has different things going on, but let's talk about the city for a second. I mean, certainly in the city of Pittsburgh proper, there has been a significant increase in the young professional adult population over the last 10 years. And that clearly reflects people choosing to live in the city and reside here. Probably job opportunities and where people choose to live, right? I mean, they might be not choosing the suburbs anymore. So we certainly have more young adults. There is certainly a big increase in the Asian American population here, either immigrants or citizens. A lot of that are students or staff at, you know, our local institutions, and certainly some refugee populations that have come here. I think without that growth, we actually would be seeing decline.
You mentioned people of Asian descent. Are there other ethnic groups that are adding to the numbers or not?
Well, I mean, in specifics, I'm not sure I have that in front of me, but I mean, certainly the big story of the city of Pittsburgh, I mean, the African-American population is declining in the city. And that decline has probably been accelerating the last few years. So, I mean, again, if you see a lot of growth, realize there's decline in what is a big part of the city. Either people leaving the city proper or the region, there might be some stability in the white population per se. But there are some folks who've been here in the city for generations who are moving out.
One more question about people of Asian descent in the city or in the region, if you prefer. Do we know if Pittsburgh is their first stop, in other words, or are they coming from another city in the U.S.? Do the numbers tell us anything about that?
Well, when I talk about these numbers broadly, I mean, realize, you know, a lot of them are students. Realize that, you know, I've estimated that of the young adult 18 to 35 population in the city of Pittsburgh, 40% are enrolled in college in some form. So really, the institutions of higher education here have a big part of the demographics, and on top of that, the staff at these institutions and the things that are growing in the region, certain high tech areas across the country, are things that have a lot more immigrant impact. I mean, people that are being brought here to work, the best talent in the world, and all that. And then on top of that, there are some refugee populations. So it's a mixed bag. I mean, I think the students come here, some leave, and that's normal for a big college town. I mean, people come here for an education. We're kind of providing that, and they're some of the best in the world. They're going to find the best opportunities, a lot of which aren't here, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think we do retain a lot of them. People think we don't, but we are a very educated young workforce here for sure.
You mentioned one of the factors in a decline, I should say, is among African Americans. Are they staying in the region? Are they just moving out of state? Do we have any sense of that? Or maybe moving to some suburbs?
I think within the county, what you're seeing, you're certainly seeing a fair, it looks to me like a lot of African-American families are moving and staying within Allegheny County. So you'll see a map of, you know, certainly the near, maybe the Mon Valley or near south, you know, south and eastern areas of the county. So I think you're seeing people kind of just going over the border from the city of Pittsburgh is my quick answer.
Okay. I want to ask you about birth rate versus death rate. What sort of an impact is that having? I mean, we still are an older county.
So a couple things. I mean, so you got to think about the region as a whole, right? People come to or the county as a whole, not just the city. Pittsburgh, the region, is one of the few regions, almost the only large region that Tampa sometimes pops up. It has a natural population decline, more deaths than births. We're an older region, really reflecting how many young folks left 30 years ago, and how little net population gain we've had over the last 20 or 30 years. And that limits, you know, the size of the population here. And it's a, you know, you can't do much about it. Folks who are trying to sort of build the population at the city or the county or the region, really, that demographic trend is out there. And, you know, you're not going to see a lot. We're not going to be growing at the rate some of the faster growing places are. So you've got to take that into account when planning for the future here. I mean, the pie is only going to be so big. If one place were to grow a lot, city of Pittsburgh maybe or whatever, really you're probably stealing that growth or maybe forcing some more decline on the Braddocks of the region. So it's a complicated issue.
So not necessarily the region grows as a whole, it's just a shifting maybe?
Well, I mean, again, this is a limiting factor to how much overall growth we're going to have at the end of the day. And so this is we're a far cry from places that have a lot of natural population decline on top of a lot of immigration. And that's where we're at.
All right. We have just a couple minutes left. I want to ask you, are there any sort of small incidents, developments that also can impact, whether it's, for instance, police being able to live outside the city of Pittsburgh or something like that? That, I mean, it's not a large population, not a large number, but when you're talking about a smaller overall number.
I think so. I mean, again, my story about the city of Pittsburgh is that, you know, we've reached a certain stability. And when we talk about every year, which is, you know, important, whether there's growth or decline, we're so close to sort of net even that all these changes could push us above or below. I mean, I think early in the decade, there was one dorm in the city of Pittsburgh that might have been put in or taken out that pushed us from like decline to growth. You know, a singular dorm. Certainly the city of police residency could have pushed out several hundred folks from the city. That could make a big difference. I saw a story this morning that the some folks want to count the residents of the county jails mm-hmm. in their places of residence. That could take out several thousand city of Pittsburgh residents on the numbers. It's not going to change anything. Right. So all these things matter when we're so close to sort of zero net growth.
All right. In our last minute or so, as we mentioned, the next full census will be taken next year. What are your thoughts on how important those numbers will be to the city of Pittsburgh, to our region, what they turn out?
Well, look, certainly want there to be the most accurate numbers because this reflects, you know, what we think is going on. A whole lot of federal funding and even some state funding is tied to it. So there's a lot of complete count efforts to try and get at populations that don't necessarily respond to census enumerators each year. So I think we want that. At the end of the day, there's some money involved, but cooperate with your local. Please respond when you get called. So that's my hope and advice for everyone.
In a sentence or two, what are the biggest impacts on whether we draw more residents? Is it the economy, availability, job, amenities?
I am I'm biased in my answer, but I think the largest attractor of folks is going to be jobs at the end of the day. Jobs into the region is the answer for the region, for the Pittsburgh region. Where people live within the region really then comes down to sort of more amenities and whatever. So the pie really is going to be whether we're generating new investment, new growth, and neighborhood level really what's there for people to want to live in.
Chris Bream is a regional economist at the University of Pittsburgh Center for Social and Urban Research. Chris, thanks so much for coming in.
Anytime.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, performing arts and robots come together on the stage. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovic and Julia Maruka. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. A reminder, if you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.